Chapter 58. Upon him, Rookwood, who had stationed relays of his own horses all the way to Dunchurch, did not mount to escape until the middle of the day, when the news of the plot was all over London. On the road, he came up with the two Wrights, Catesby and Percy, and they all galloped together into Northamptonshire, thence to Dunchurch, where they found the proposed party assembled. Finding, however, that there had been a plot, and that it had been discovered, the party disappeared in the course of the night, and left them alone with Sir Everard Digby. Away they all rode again, through Warwickshire and Worcestershire, to a house called Holbitch, on the borders of Staffordshire. They tried to raise the Catholics on their way, but were indignantly driven off by them. All this time they were hotly pursued by the Sheriff of Worcester, and a fast increasing concourse of riders. At last, resolving to defend themselves at Holbitch, they shut themselves up in the house, and put some wet powder before the fire to dry. But it blew up, and Catesby was singed and blackened, and almost killed, and some of the others were sadly hurt. Still, knowing that they must die, they resolved to die there, and with only their swords in their hands appeared at the windows, to be shot at by the sheriff and his assistants. Catesby said to Thomas Winter, after Thomas had been hit in the right arm which dropped powerless by his side, "Stand by me, Tom, and we will die together." ... which they did, being shot through the body by two bullets from one gun. John Wright, and Christopher Wright, and Percy, were also shot. Rookwood and Digby were taken, the former with a broken arm, and a wound in his body too. It was the 15th of January, before the trial of Guy Fawkes, and such of the other conspirators as were left alive, came on. They were all found guilty, all hanged, drawn, and quartered. Some, in St. Paul's Churchyard, on the top of Ludgate Hill, some, before the Parliament House. A Jesuit priest, named Henry Garnet, to whom the dreadful design was said to have been communicated, was taken and tried, and two of his servants, as well as a poor priest who was taken with him, were tortured without mercy. He himself was not tortured, but was surrounded in the Tower by tamperers and traitors, and so was made unfairly to convict himself out of his own mouth. He said, upon his trial, that he had done all he could to prevent the deed, and that he could not make public what had been told him in confession, though I am afraid he knew of the plot in other ways. He was found guilty and executed, after a manful defense, and the Catholic Church made a saint of him. Some rich and powerful persons, who had had nothing to do with the project, were fined and imprisoned for it by the Star Chamber. The Catholics, in general, who had recoiled with horror from the idea of the infernal contrivance, were unjustly put under more severe laws than before, and this was the end of the gunpowder plot. Second part, his soship would pretty willingly, I think, have blown the House of Commons into the air himself, for his dread and jealousy of it knew no bounds all through his reign. When he was hard pressed for money he was obliged to order it to meet, as he could get no money without it, and when it asked him first to abolish some of the monopolies in necessaries of life which were a great grievance to the people, and to redress other public wrongs, he flew into a rage, and got rid of it again. At one time he wanted it to consent to the union of England with Scotland, and quarreled about that. At another time it wanted him to put down a most infamous church abuse, called the High Commission Court, and he quarreled with it about that. At another time it entreated him not to be quite so fond of his archbishops and bishops who made speeches in his praise too awful to be related, but to have some little consideration for the poor Puritan clergy who were persecuted for preaching in their own way, and not according to the archbishops and bishops, and they quarreled about that. In short, what with hating the House of Commons, and pretending not to hate it, and what with now sending some of its members who opposed him, to Newgate or to the Tower, and now telling the rest that they must not presume to make speeches about the public affairs which could not possibly concern them. And what with cajoling, and bullying, and fighting, and being frightened, the House of Commons was the plague of his Soship's existence. It was pretty firm, however, in maintaining its rights, and insisting that the Parliament should make the laws, and not the King by his own single proclamations, which he tried hard to do, and his Soship was so often distressed for money, in consequence, that he sold every sort of title and public office, as if they were merchandise, and even invented a new dignity called a baronetcy, which anybody could buy for £1,000. These disputes with his parliaments, and his hunting, and his drinking, and his lying in bed, for he was a great sluggard, occupied his Soship pretty well. The rest of his time he chiefly passed in hugging and slobbering his favorites. The first of these was Sir Philip Herbert, who had no knowledge whatever, except of dogs, and horses, and hunting, but whom he soon made Earl of Montgomery. The next, and a much more famous one, was Robert Carr, or Kerr, for it is not certain which was his right name, who came from the border country, and whom he soon made Viscount Rochester, and afterwards, Earl of Somerset. The way in which his Soship doted on this handsome young man is even more odious to think of than the way in which the really great men of England condescended to bow down before him. The favorite's great friend was a certain Sir Thomas Overbury, who wrote his love letters for him, and assisted him in the duties of his many high places, which his own ignorance prevented him from discharging. But this same Sir Thomas, having just manhood enough to dissuade the favorite from a wicked marriage with the beautiful Countess of Essex, who was to get a divorce from her husband for the purpose, the said Countess, in her rage, got Sir Thomas put into the Tower, and there poisoned him. Then the favorite and this bad woman were publicly married by the King's pet bishop, with as much to do and rejoicing, as if he had been the best man, and she the best woman, upon the face of the earth. But, after a longer sunshine than might have been expected of 7 years or so, that is to say, another handsome young man started up, and eclipsed the Earl of Somerset. This was George Villiers, the youngest son of a Leicestershire gentleman, who came to court with all the Paris fashions on him, and could dance as well as the best mountebank that ever was seen. He soon danced himself into the good graces of his Soship, and danced the other favorite out of favor. Then, it was all at once discovered that the Earl and Countess of Somerset had not deserved all those great promotions and mighty rejoicings, and they were separately tried for the murder of Sir Thomas Overbury, and for other crimes. But, the King was so afraid of his late favorites publicly telling some disgraceful things he knew of him which he darkly threatened to do, that he was even examined with two men standing, one on either side of him, each with a cloak in his hand, ready to throw it over his head and stop his mouth, if he should break out with what he had it in his power to tell. So, a very lame affair was purposely made of the trial, and his punishment was an allowance of £4,000 a year in retirement, while the Countess was pardoned, and allowed to pass into retirement too. They hated one another by this time, and lived to revile and torment each other some years. While these events were in progress, and while his Soship was making such an exhibition of himself, from day to day, and from year to year, as is not often seen in any sty, three remarkable deaths took place in England. The first was that of the minister, Robert Cecil, Earl of Salisbury, who was past 60, and had never been strong, being deformed from his birth. He said at last that he had no wish to live, and no minister need have had, with his experience of the meanness and wickedness of those disgraceful times. The second was that of the Lady Arabella Stuart, who alarmed his Soship mightily by privately marrying William Seymour, son of Lord Beauchamp, who was a descendant of King Henry VII, and who, his Soship thought, might consequently increase and strengthen any claim she might one day set up to the throne. She was separated from her husband, who was put in the tower, and thrust into a boat, to be confined at Durham. She escaped in a man's dress to get away in a French ship from Gravesend to France, but unhappily missed her husband, who had escaped too, and was soon taken. She went raving mad in the miserable tower, and died there after 4 years. The last, and the most important of these three deaths, was that of Prince Henry, the heir to the throne, in the 19th year of his age. He was a promising young prince, and greatly liked, a quiet, well-conducted youth, of whom two very good things are known. First, that his father was jealous of him. Secondly, that he was the friend of Sir Walter Raleigh, languishing through all those years in the tower, and often said, that no man, but his father would keep such a bird in such a cage. On the occasion of the preparations for the marriage of his sister the Princess Elizabeth with a foreign prince, and an unhappy marriage it turned out, he came from Richmond, where he had been very ill, to greet his new brother-in-law, at the palace at Whitehall. There he played a great game of tennis, in his shirt, though it was very cold weather, and was seized with an alarming illness, and died within a fortnight of a putrid fever. For this young prince Sir Walter Raleigh wrote, in his prison in the tower, the beginning of a history of the world. A wonderful instance how little his soship could do to confine a great man's mind, however long he might imprison his body. And this mention of Sir Walter Raleigh, who had many faults, but who never showed so many merits as in trouble and adversity, may bring me at once to the end of his sad story. After an imprisonment in the tower of 12 long years, he proposed to resume those old sea voyages of his, and to go to South America in search of gold. His soship, divided between his wish to be on good terms with the Spaniards through whose territory Sir Walter must pass, he had long had an idea of marrying Prince Henry to a Spanish princess, and his avaricious eagerness to get hold of the gold did not know what to do. But, in the end, he set Sir Walter free, taking securities for his return, and Sir Walter fitted out an expedition at his own coast, and, on the 28th of March, 1617, sailed away in command of one of its ships, which he ominously called the Destiny. The expedition failed. The common men, not finding the gold they had expected, mutinied. A quarrel broke out between Sir Walter and the Spaniards, who hated him for old successes of his against them, and he took and burned a little town called St. Thomas. For this he was denounced to his soship by the Spanish ambassador as a pirate, and returning almost broken-hearted, with his hopes and fortunes shattered, his company of friends dispersed, and his brave son, who had been one of them, killed, he was taken through the treachery of Sir Louis Stukely, his near relation, a scoundrel and a vice-admiral, and was once again immured in his prison home of so many years. His soship being mightily disappointed in not getting any gold, Sir Walter Raleigh was tried as unfairly, and with as many lies and evasions as the judges and law officers, and every other authority in church and state habitually practiced under such a king. After a great deal of prevarication on all parts but his own, it was declared that he must die under his former sentence, now 15 years old. So, on the 28th of October, 1618, he was shut up in the gatehouse at Westminster, to pass his late night on earth, and there he took leave of his good and faithful lady who was worthy to have lived in better days. At 8 o'clock next morning, after a cheerful breakfast, and a pipe, and a cup of good wine, he was taken to Old Palace Yard in Westminster, where the scaffold was set up, and where so many people of high degree were assembled to see him die, that it was a matter of some difficulty to get him through the crowd. He behaved most nobly, but if anything lay heavy on his mind, it was that Earl of Essex, whose head he had seen roll off. And he solemnly said that he had had no hand in bringing him to the block, and that he had shed tears for him when he died. As the morning was very cold, the sheriff said, Would he come down to a fire for a little space, and warm himself? But Sir Walter thanked him, and said no, he would rather it were done at once, for he was ill of fever and ague, and in another quarter of an hour his shaking fit would come upon him, if he were still alive, and his enemies might then suppose that he trembled for fear. With that, he kneeled and made a very beautiful and Christian prayer. Before he laid his head upon the block he felt the edge of the axe, and said, with a smile upon his face, that it was a sharp medicine, but would cure the worst disease. When he was bent down ready for death, he said to the executioner, finding that he hesitated, "What dost thou fear? Strike, man!" Apostrophe so, the axe came down, and struck his head off, in the 66th year of his age. The new favorite got on fast. He was made a viscount, he was made Duke of Buckingham, he was made a marquis, he was made master of the horse, he was made Lord High Admiral, and the chief commander of the gallant English forces that had dispersed the Spanish Armada, was displaced to make room for him. He had the whole kingdom at his disposal, and his mother sold all the profits and honors of the state, as if she had kept a shop. He blazed all over with diamonds and other precious stones, from his hatband and his earrings to his shoes. Yet he was an ignorant, presumptuous, swaggering compound of knave and fool, with nothing but his beauty and his dancing to recommend him. This is the gentleman who called himself His Majesty's dog and slave, and called His Majesty your soship. His soship called him Steenie, it is supposed, because that was a nickname for Stephen, and because Saint Stephen was generally represented in pictures as a handsome saint. His soship was driven sometimes to his wit's end by his trimming between the general dislike of the Catholic religion at home, and his desire to wheedle and flatter it abroad, as his only means of getting a rich princess for his son's wife, a part of whose fortune he might cram into his greasy pockets. Prince Charles, or as his soship called him, Baby Charles, being now Prince of Wales, the old project of a marriage with the Spanish king's daughter had been revived for him, and as she could not marry a Protestant without leave from the Pope, his soship himself secretly and meanly wrote to his infallibility, asking for it. The negotiation for this Spanish marriage takes up a larger space in great books than you can imagine. But the upshot of it all is, that when it had been held off by the Spanish court for a long time, Baby Charles and Steenie set off in disguise as Mr. Thomas Smith and Mr. John Smith, to see the Spanish princess. That Baby Charles pretended to be desperately in love with her, and jumped off walls to look at her, and made a considerable fool of himself in a good many ways. That she was called Princess of Wales, and that the whole Spanish court believed Baby Charles to be all but dying for her sake, as he expressly told them he was. That Baby Charles and Steenie came back to England, and were received with as much rapture as if they had been a blessing to it. That Baby Charles had actually fallen in love with Henrietta Maria, the French king's sister, whom he had seen in Paris. That he thought it a wonderfully fine and princely thing, to have deceived the Spaniards, all through, and that he openly said, with a chuckle, as soon as he was safe, and sound at home again, that the Spaniards were great fools to have believed him. Like most dishonest men, the prince and the favorite complained, that the people whom they had deluded were dishonest. They made such misrepresentations of the treachery of the Spaniards in this business of the Spanish match, that the English nation became eager for a war with them. Although the gravest Spaniards laughed at the idea of his soship in a warlike attitude, the Parliament granted money for the beginning of hostilities, and the treaties with Spain were publicly declared to be at an end. The Spanish ambassador in London, probably with the help of the fallen favorite, the Earl of Somerset, being unable to obtain speech with his soship, slipped a paper into his hand, declaring that he was a prisoner in his own house, and was entirely governed by Buckingham and his creatures. The first effect of this letter was that his soship began to cry and whine, and took baby Charles away from Steenie, and went down to Windsor, gabbling all sorts of nonsense. The end of it was that his soship hugged his dog and slave, and said he was quite satisfied. He had given the prince and the favorite almost unlimited power to settle anything with the Pope as to the Spanish marriage, and he now, with a view to the French one, signed a treaty that all Roman Catholics in England should exercise their religion freely, and should never be required to take any oath contrary thereto. In return for this, and for other concessions much less to be defended, Henrietta Maria was to become the prince's wife, and was to bring him a fortune of 800,000 crowns. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.